Sure.
It's not often you hear those two words in the same sentences.
Well, and I, you know, I think, given all that's going on, it would be a really, really good political idea, move, and just the right thing to do, after all, right?
I mean, it would send so many...
Of the right...
It would send heads exploding all over.
Well, and there's another value, exploding heads. Yeah, that would complete the... All right. Good morning. It is December 31st, 2009, roughly 10 a.m. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission with our regularly scheduled annual New Year's Eve meeting, as also our regularly scheduled bi-weekly meeting. This is Kevin Kramer along with Tony Clark and Brian Kulk wishing everybody a happy new year and welcome to today's meeting. Any opening comments from my fellow commissioners?
Good morning and welcome. Happy New Year.
And the same thing, and I also just want to thank everyone. Today marks the one-year anniversary of being part of the commission, so I want to thank the staff and the media, fellow commissioners. It was, knock on wood, things seem to go pretty well this first year.
It only seems like two. With that, I would entertain a motion to approve the consent
agenda. So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We'll move to the regular agenda, beginning with my portfolio, KC1. I move the commission authorize the Abandoned Mine Lands Division to hold a public meeting to discuss the 2010 Beekler-Velva AML project and to solicit input on other abandoned mines of concern.
Second.
The AML reclamation plan that was approved this year by the Office of Surface Mining requires public meetings to be held in counties in which reclamation work is planned. And next year, the AML division is planning to undertake an abandoned mine lands reclamation project at the Beekler-Velva AML site south of Sawyer and Velva. This site in the AML inventory actually contains a number of abandoned surface and underground coal mines. Plans are being developed to backfill about 2 miles of hazardous high walls resulting from surface mining activities. It is appropriate, therefore, to hold a public meeting, and we're going to hold it in Minot to inform interested persons about the project and to receive input on other mines in the area. The meeting is scheduled for January 20th at the Ward County Courthouse, starting at 6:30 Central Standard Time.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC2. I move the commission approve bond release number 2 for surface coal mining permit number BDSU 8011, held by the American Colloid Company for the Smith Ullman Mine, to release all reclamation liabilities on 99.24 acres of land located in Section 8, T120 and 129 North, R94 West, Adams County. The release will become effective February 1, 2010, unless a formal hearing is requested.
Second.
The American Colloid Mine submitted their application for bond release earlier this year. The 99.24 acres consists of 50 of the acres are native grassland. The other 49.2 are undisturbed. This is a leonardite mine. The mining took place on this tract from 78 through 80 and from 89 through 99. Everything seems to be in order. It should be noted that some of the original permit area and a lot of the adjacent area were previously mined by underground and surface coal mining methods prior to any reclamation laws, and so our AML division has completed several reclamation projects as well in the area. So,
all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC3. I move the commission adopt the order granting certificate concerning Montana Dakota Utilities Company's request to extend the service area granted by Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity number 5325 to allow for taps into its existing 16-mile pipeline serving U.S. bioenergy and to extend facilities from the taps to locations beyond the existing line to customers within the townships of Brightwood, Waldo, DeVio, Lamars, and Fairmont of Richland County, North Dakota, case number PU09649.
Second.
It's kind of a banner day in the natural gas industry in North Dakota with the announcement earlier, I guess yesterday, that the Prairie Rose line that EOG constructed is in service now with a tap in at Up at, where is it? Up at, where? Yeah. Well, yeah, it's from Palermo over to the Alliance Pipeline, tapping in, allowing for capacity of about, what, 80 MCF per day of North Dakota gas. And then on the other end, down by Fairmont, of course, is this MDU tap, the 16-mile tap that we had approved, I don't know, I guess it seems like yesterday, but perhaps over a year ago now. And what this PCNN does is it allows them in these five counties, it allows MDU in these five counties to extend service where it is requested. It is our understanding that there are at least a couple of grain facilities as well as a flour mill in the area that is interested in utilizing natural gas from the MDU line off of the Alliance line. There may be other opportunities. The interesting thing to me is that along with the 80 MCF that is being, you know, tapped into on the north end, at least of the North Dakota version or North Dakota portion of the Alliance pipeline, we solve that opportunity, that market opportunity issue for some of North Dakota's natural gas that comes out of the Bakken. On the other end, we're solving some opportunity for further industrial development in the east, which has been a long time issue in North Dakota, and providing some firm service for eastern North Dakota. And perhaps there might, you know, be some other opportunity yet, because it's my understanding the Alliance pipeline still has additional capacity in it as well. So anyway, we're seeing a lot of natural gas production as well as natural gas market opportunities and use opportunities in North Dakota. So it's a good time to be us, as I like to say.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Us being North Dakotans. KC4.
Public service.
As opposed to public service commissioners. KC4. I move the commission approve bond release number 3 for surface coal mining permit number NACT9101 held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine to release all reclamation liabilities on 628.71 acres of land located in Section 22 T145 North R86 West in Mercer County. The release will become effective February 1, 2010 unless a formal hearing is requested.
Second.
This is a good chunk of land, obviously, a good chunk of reclamation. 529 acres of the 628 are reclaimed cropland. Another 85.5 acres of land are undisturbed cropland. And about 14.2 acres, to be precise, of the reclaimed land is County Road. And this is land that was initially disturbed in 1993, and coal removal was completed in 1995. And backfilling grading completed in 97. Everything seems to be in order, meets all of the standards. The county road folks are very pleased with the county road, and the cropland all seems to be doing very well. So everything's in order. We'd like to see all of this final bond release.
Yeah, this is a good bond release, and I'm sure over the next week or so we'll be having staff look back at 2009 and total up the total number of acres that were released. But we had a good year.
We did. I had them do that very thing, in fact, just before coming in here. There, in 2009, there were 13 final bond releases, totaling 4,653 acres that will be approved this year. If these two, there are three, I think, today, bond release motions are brought to completion by February 1, 2010, we anticipate that they would be, it'd be 13 final bond releases totaling 4,653 acres. The interesting thing about that is, in addition to it, you know, seeming like a large number, when you consider that we're just under 21,000 acres that have been final bond released since mining began in North Dakota, that's a pretty high percentage. So you're right, it's been a banner year for bond release in North Dakota.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I know there's at least one more. Is there a KC6?
We've got five.
Oh, there it is. I've got two clipped together. That's what threw me off a little bit. Okay, KC5. I move the commission submit the 2010 to 2013 North Dakota Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Simplified Grant Application to the Office of Surface Mining to request $3,498,697 in federal funds for the Abandoned Mine Lands Program.
Second.
The amount of the application is about $500,000 more than the amount of our current grant due to an increase in OSM's allocation of the prior balance replacement funds in accordance with, as you might recall, the 2006 amendments to the federal reclamation law. As calculated by OSM, our total mandatory distribution from the sources of the funds for fiscal year 2010 abandoned mine lands grant will be $3,398,697. But in addition to that amount, this grant requests another $100,000 for funding our emergency program, which we have tapped into a fair bit in recent years when there are some large sinkholes that pop up here and there. And occasionally we'll even seek an additional funding for a outcrop fire or something. At any rate, it should be noted that this grant covers 1 year time period in the ending February 20th, 2011 for administrative costs. It should be noted that we budgeted for a second seasonal construction inspector as well for this grant period. So while there's more money available, it provides us opportunity to reclaim more abandoned mined lands in a faster period and enhancing the safety of everybody concerned.
I'd also like to note, too, I looked through this because it caught my eye, the simplified grant application, it's only 30 pages. So I don't know what the previous version was.
Federal government's getting a lot more efficient at putting out money.
All right. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right.
They're sending it to congressional districts that don't even exist. So it's gotten really simple.
It's really simple, yes. KC6, I move the commission approve the rider that increases the amount of self-bond number SB9501-1 and approve collateral bond number CB9501-5 that covers all permits held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine. I further move the approval of the cancellation of collateral bond number CB9501-4.
Second.
Speaking of really large numbers, I think we were. Coteau filed their application for revision to a permit number NACT0401 for Freedom Mine to revise their worst case reclamation cost estimate. It also used the reclamation division's annual update of variable costs under our policies. Staff completed the review and determined the bond amount for the consolidated bond area needed to be increased. The current bond amount of $88,200,000 covers all permits at the Freedom Mine. The total bond amount has to be increased as a result of new reclamation cost estimates and is based on the new worst-case reclamation condition in all permits at the Freedom Mine. The minimum bond amount must now be at least $100,343,439. Coteau has filed a rider to increase the amount of the self-bond and provided a new collateral bond that totals $102 million. It includes a $1,656,561 contingency for future increases in reclamation costs. The amount of the new collateral bond is $10,200,000, and the self-bond amount is being increased to $91,800,000, which adds up to the $102 million that I talked of previously. What we do is we allow mining companies to provide up to 90% of their bond in the form of a self-bond. The other 10% must be collateral or surety bond. The assumption in that formula is that the collateral or surety bond would be readily available should something happen, and then that would provide time for the rest to be accessed as necessary, the rest being the self-bonding. Coteau is able to self-bond with the guarantee of a third-party guarantee from Basin Electric. Basin Electric and Coteau together meet all of the financial requirements, including a A2 rating from Moody's. So everything seems to be in order for this increased bond. But, boy, those are some large numbers. You start talking about the hundreds of millions. I don't know about you, Commissioner Kalk, but for me that's still a lot of money.
As long as it's simplified.
Yeah, as long as it's simplified. This is how it goes, Peterson, on New Year's Eve. I'm sorry.
All in favor?
Aye.
Holiday party starts at 11.
That ends the items of my portfolio, Commissioner Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. TC1, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE09740, canceling warehouse license number 1219 issued to Modern Grain, Inc. at Beulah, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Beulah, North Dakota is discontinued effective December 17th, 2009.
Second.
Our licensing division received a request to discontinue business from Modern Grain of Hebron for their licensed grain warehouse at Beulah. They no longer wish to license that particular elevator. There are no outstanding storage obligations at the warehouse.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE09745, granting the request of Identity Preserved Ingredients, LLC, to operate a 15,000-bushel grain warehouse at Hillsboro, North Dakota, effective immediately.
Second.
Commission received a license application to operate this 15,000-bushel grain warehouse at Hillsboro. Identity Preserved Ingredients has been operating a certified seed plant at Hillsboro for some time, but they are now expanding their business line and need a warehouse license to begin those operations.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC3, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE09746, canceling warehouse license number 7 issued to Mott Grain Company and ordering that business at Mott, North Dakota is discontinued effective immediately.
Second.
Again, the commission received this request to discontinue business from the Mott Grain Company. They've not been buying grain and selling for some time now and decided to drop their grain warehouse license. They have no inventory nor any outstanding obligations.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC4, I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in the applications of Basin Electric Power Cooperative for a waiver of procedure and time schedule, a corridor certificate, and a route permit in its 230 kV electric transmission line in Morton and Oliver counties of North Dakota, case number PU09587.
Second.
We had discussed this particular project a bit a few weeks ago when this first went on the commission agenda. It's essentially a fairly short transmission line that's designed to hook up the wind power that'll be provided by the Bison One field that Minnesota Power is building, and connect it to its Square Butte substation, which is located adjacent to the Milton R. Young plant. The hearing that the commission will be holding, as proposed in this order, is scheduled for February 1st, 2010, at 10 a.m. Central Standard Time at the Oliver County Courthouse in Center.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC5, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order in case number RR09651, BNSF Railway Company Review of Private Railroad Crossings Application. This is the first opportunity that the commission has had to have one of these particular types of proceedings. It relates to a statutory change that the legislature made in the last legislative session and went into effect at the as of August 1. Basically, what the law does is it says that as of tomorrow, so the end of this year, the way that whistles are handled at private crossings changes a little bit. Under the former law, it indicated that a railroad had to blow its whistle within a certain distance from any what they termed a road or street crossing. It didn't really identify public or private crossings. It just said road or street. So it was a little bit ambiguous. In addition, there are some federal rail safety laws that come into play. Basically, what the change means is that there are a number of crossings throughout the state of North Dakota that, for whatever reason in the past, private crossings had whistles from trains blown at them. And there's a presumption now in the law as of the end of this year that the whistles not be blown unless a party brings to the commission a proceeding to require the railroad to continue to blow at those private crossings. Of course, public crossings still have all the same requirements that they've always had, especially under federal law, which really preempts a lot of this. But we're talking about private crossings where the whistles need no longer be blown. Burlington Northern, on its own accord, brought this particular petition to the commission for us to review. Initially, they had 7 crossings that they wanted us to take a look at. They peeled one of those off because a tree that was obstructing a view was subsequently cut down. I don't know that we ever determined who cut it down, whether it was a landowner in any case, they pulled that one from the list. Essentially, the BNSF currently has approximately 517 private railroad crossings in the state. Some of those have traditionally had a whistle blown at them, some of them not. They, up to this point, have reviewed 88 of those crossings where there were whistle stops. And of those 88, they brought these seven and now six crossings that they wish to continue to blow them at. All of them really related to obstructed views, whether it be a curvature in the rail track or a shelter belt or just the nature of the approach to the rail grade. And in each of those, they brought a number of exhibits that they submitted during the course of the testimony that indicated that they were indeed blocked. We did receive testimony opposing this request from the representatives of the state's railroad engineer unions, and while I appreciated that testimony, I do have to say that I was unpersuaded that these should not be listed as sites that need to have the whistle stops blown. The engineer's concern was mainly as a matter of convenience to them and to the public, too, that might not wish to have whistles blown at these sites. The problem is, however, these are obstructed views, and if they're obstructed for the vehicle that may be crossing, it means that they are obstructed for the railroad engineer themselves, too. The engineers indicated that there's still flexibility in the law for them on an as-needed basis to blow whistles at any of these private crossings, but of course the problem is if they themselves can't see the cars just as the cars can't see them, then it would make it very difficult for them to make that particular judgment call. So this order does approve those six particular crossings. If you have an interest in Q&A, we can go through exactly where each of those are, but I think in a situation like this, if the commission's going to err on one side or another when you're talking about rail safety, it makes sense to side on the side of safety.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I would like to go back to TC4, mm-hmm. if we could. There is a need for a correction on that motion.
Oh.
It's if the second line, it has Basin Electric Power Cooperative, and it should read Elite Incorporated.
I thought about that
Inc.
as I was reading it.
So I would entertain a motion to correct that.
I think we'll consider it errata, if that's all right. And
that's fine.
So we don't have to have a re-motion.
All right, thank you.
Is that okay? So. The minutes will reflect such.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Without objection. TC6, I move the commission adopt the order reissuing certificate in the joint application of Basin Electric Power Cooperative, Inc. and Prairie Winds North Dakota 1, Inc. to transfer certificate of site compatibility for energy conversion facility number 14 from Basin Electric Power Cooperative, Inc. to Prairie Winds ND1, Inc., case number PU09692.
Second.
This will authorize really what's deals with a corporate organizational issue within Basin. As you all know, the Prairie Winds project, which has just been completed south of Minot, which the commission authorized. Originally, when we issued that certificate authorizing construction, it was granted to Basin Electric Power Cooperative. Basin has created a wholly owned subsidiary within itself, Prairie Winds Inc., to be the entity that actually operates that. And so from a legal standpoint, we would need to transfer that certificate to the wholly owned subsidiary, Prairie Winds, which is a corporation organized under the cooperative corporation. So this does that. I suppose it may make sense at this time. I think we may talk about it here in a little bit. I know Commissioner Kramer asked Jerry to update the wind sheet. It's been an impressive year in North Dakota for wind power development. The pace of growth, I happened to go out and look at compared to other states, the number of megawatts of wind power that have come online. The pace of growth in North Dakota has been faster than just about anywhere. We're in the top five of states as far as actual megawatts added in the last year. We're over 1,100 megawatts now, 1,186, according to our calculations of megawatts that are currently online. We're most assuredly in the top about five states as far as percentage of wind power as compared to other power produced in the state. And while we may not quite be in the top 10, it'll be interesting to see where things shake out here over the next few weeks. Other states, of course, are building as well, so it's a little bit fluid as far as whether we'll fall in that top 10. But if we're not, we're awfully close, which is impressive considering within 10 years ago we were basically number 50. We're now, if not number 10 or in the top 10, we're close to it. So it's been a very rapid build-out. Especially impressive considering our distance from market, which is a traditional issue for North Dakota, but I think it indicates the really tremendous wind resource that that we have here, and also a public policy commitment from the legislature, the governor, the commission, local officials to have a state that is open to do business and looks to have all forms of energy developed within it.
Well, if I could just throw a thought, add to what Tony said, and Kevin talked about the importance of natural gas. I mean, look at our state right now, where wind is going great, where more natural gas coming online, we're doing great work in the coal fields, talk about all the reclamation projects doing, all the oil work. And the only thing that threatens the future of our state is the policies that are coming out of the federal government. You know, keep the federal government out of what we're doing in North Dakota. We're doing it right here. I think that's the message for me for 2009, is let us do what we need to do at the state level and keep the federal government out of our knickers.
Is that a resolution?
That's my resolution. But I really mean that. I mean, everything in North Dakota is going very well. We just need to have policies to support what we're doing here at the state.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC-7, I move the commission under NDCC 600209.1 adopt the order suspending warehouse license number 1156 of Organic Grain and Milling, Inc., Boulder, Colorado, at their Clyde, North Dakota warehouse, effective December 29th, 2009, for lack of adequate bond, and issue a notice of opportunity to be heard in case number GE09751.
Second.
This motion and the next motion that are on the agenda both deal with the same facility located in Clyde. This particular one suspends the warehouse license as a matter of law. They have, they meaning Organic Grain and Milling, has failed to post an adequate bond. Under state law, if a bond is not posted or reauthorized 30 days prior to the expiration of that licensee's bond, then the commission suspends the license. It's not revoked at that point. It only comes after the actual end date, but it suspends the license, and that's what we're doing in this particular motion. I'll talk about the next motion in just a moment.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
TC-8, I move the commission under NDCC 6002.10.1 adopt the order authorizing limited operations as requested by Organic Grain and Milling, Inc., in case number GE09751.
Second.
In discussions with Organic Grain and Milling, it became evident that there were at least some continuing operations that they felt were necessary to happen as far as shipping grain that they had already had, some of those kind of business operations to ensure that that the business could remain afloat. And of course, in a matter like this, it's not the commission's intent to do harm to the business, but rather to protect the grain selling public. And so what this does is it basically modifies what has just happened, allowing them to continue certain business operations such as shipping some of the grain that they already have on hand, but does not allow them to actually receive new grain from those who may be selling it to them. So it allows them the ability to at least maintain operations. The hope is that they'll be able to file a replacement bond after posting, sounded like a collateral with the bonding company, and they indicated to us they believe that that is imminent and will happen, and so we're hopeful that that happens.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That ends the items in my portfolio.
A couple of things. One of the things I failed to announce earlier, I should have during the motion, with regard to the railroad crossing issue, I was not in appearance. I did not make an appearance at the hearing. I did, however, listen to the entire audio record of the hearing, as well as, of course, read all of the testimony and reviewed all of the pictures and all of those things. So, also, I want to make sure. I don't know. I know Dean Peterson's here for some big announcement, and I suspect maybe what he was waiting for was for us to announce that this is his last day on the job at North American Coal. He has been a fixture of coal, at least in the, his current capacity. I suppose he's going to be a high-paid consultant after this or something. I don't know. But at any rate.
Actually, I heard, I heard he wanted to make full circle and come back and work for the commission.
Well, hey, listen, we have a lot of stimulus money. We're looking to hire some folks. So we're looking for a wind developer. We want wind turbines on those reclaimed ridges. Oh, gosh, that's enough irreverence for a holiday, I think. With that, are there any questions? They'd give him a gratis.
The excuse me, the organic grain and milling case, is it, I mean, does it make sense to allow them to like to ship grain if that's collateral for I mean, if they go out of business for some reason, isn't that the collateral that a someone who hasn't been paid would call upon to be
well,
paid?
Well, it's always a judgment call that the commission uses in any matter like this, and it's as I said, the commission itself doesn't wish to become the reason that a business is unable to meet its obligations, and there can be a chain of events that happen if, because of our order, they're unable to deliver grain that they have obligations to deliver. So it's a judgment call. In this case, I don't think we have any indication that farmers haven't been paid as of this point. So there aren't some of those other extenuating circumstances. And I see Sue's reaching for a mic, so I'll certainly welcome her to make some comments as well. But, you know, we are hopeful that they're able to get the bond and then they'll be fully licensed again.
And I was going to mention that this is grain that they've cleaned and processed, and all warehouse receipts that they have issued, they have grain in their facility to cover those obligations.
As far as what is the amount of their bond?
It's $62,500.
And they have not been able to get a bond for that amount?
They're working on replacing it. They are, I've been notified this morning that they're in the process of finalizing their indemnification papers so that they can obtain a letter of credit to provide to the bonding company.
Okay, and when does their bond expire, the bond they have presently?
The last date it'll be in effect is January 27th.
Okay. Could you please tell me where, refresh my memory on where Prairie Winds is located?
Prairie Winds is located just south of Minot. It's a fairly sizable wind field, and it's right, I mean, it straddles basically US 83. If you're driving from Bismarck to Minot, you can't miss it.
It has it has stunned many travelers who, in the last couple of months, that I've heard say, whoa, my goodness, when did this happen?
With transmission being an issue,
mm-hmm.
are we reaching a point where, you know,
saturation?
Bottleneck?
Well, it's a great question.
5 years ago, we were talking about the same thing. That, you know, we have these transmission constraint issues, and that was, you know, now here we are, what, 700-800 megawatts later, and we still see sites coming online. What we've been able to do, I think, effectively in North Dakota, and when I say we, it's really the utility companies who are developing it, is they've been able to find pockets on the grid where they can put 150 megawatts here, 200 megawatts there. There have been some transmission upgrades that have been required to get them onto the grid, but they're finding spots to do it. Now, I think the transmission challenge that everybody's identified is if we are talking about truly large-scale wind development to serve a much larger need, perhaps a national need, transporting wind power to the east, then undoubtedly there needs to be some sort of high voltage overlay. It can't happen. But for the most part, it's been regional utilities serving regional needs, and so they've been able to do that, with a few exceptions.
Well, and some of those same utilities are able to balance their own loads accordingly. So, there's been curtailment that we've heard of, a significant curtailment of some of the coal-fired plants to make room for some of the wind, and so there you're just trading one source resource for another resource, and that still doesn't add as much value as we ultimately like to add in terms of our export capacity. You know, Brian made an interesting point earlier about the federal government and policies and the lack really of a comprehensive energy policy. I always say you want to have a good, solid national energy policy, just turn it over to North Dakota. We've cited many transmission lines, in fact, some fairly significant, 60-mile-plus transmission lines in North Dakota here in a matter of 30, 60, 90 days without compromising the integrity of our charge. And we were able to take advantage of all of the resources under, on top of, and over the ground. And so, I'm pretty proud of the work that's been done, not just by this commission, but by the utilities and the industries and the local jurisdictions in our state.
I think what's going to be interesting is that 2009, I think, saw demand kind of level off around the country because of the economic slowdown. When industry starts pumping again and demand starts increasing the way it has been, then we're going to see some real opportunities and challenges for transmission lines, because then they're going to want all the wind we can send down the line, all the coal we can send on the line. And that's where I think the 2010 and beyond, as the industry revolves or rebuilds itself, if you will, and demand gets back up there, that'll be the next challenge.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the extent of the expansion of the industry this year? Tony mentioned something. How much has gone online?
Oh, in how much do I trust my math?
In terms of wind?
Yeah, in terms of wind, it's several hundred megawatts.
I think a year ago we were at about 700 megawatts. Today we're at 1,186. There's a wonderful site, and it might be the OWEA site. I could find it, but where it literally goes year by year, state by state, you could chart the progress. 6 years ago, we were at 5 megawatts of commercial nameplate wind capacity.
We can total it up for you.
Yeah, I think it's between 400 and 500.
Now, how much is pending at this point?
Another 6,000.
6,000?
That we had.
What you consider?
Yeah, right. We have some form of, beginning with letter of intent, some level of jurisdictional application, if you will, or at least we've been informed of up to 6,000 more megawatts that are in somebody's queue. They're just under
5,800, 6,000, somewhere on there.
A lot. About $12 billion worth of additional investment.
There was a lot of discussion last year, too, Dale, about that 760 kV line, or Dave, that's going to be looping through the state. So I think there's a lot of major transmission projects that are out there being worked. I know MDU is thinking about partnering up with them a little bit. And as you see these wind projects come online, they're going to be kind of feeding upon themselves as demand gets increased.
Well, and speaking of comprehensive federal energy policy, that we get kind of hung up on things like climate change and EPA issues, which are pretty critical and important. But this issue of transmission cost allocation and recovery is as big an issue as anything that could open up lots of development for places like North Dakota.
Dale, I came up with about 422. I was adding Ashtabula, Prairie Winds, Laverne, and Rugby.
422 this year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If memory serves, those are the four that came online.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Could you run through the numbers again as far as the collateral bond, self and collateral bond increases for Coteau?
I can, but I'm going to look them up to make sure I get them exactly right, although the new numbers are pretty well rounded. The current bond, oops, that's not what I was looking for. Yeah, why don't you just go ahead and give that to him?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. All right. The amount of money that you're asking for the simplified grant is $3,398,000. What, please?
That's for construction.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another $100,000 for the administrative or for the emergencies. And the emergencies are those, you know, sinkholes that suddenly come up that we weren't planning on, of course, that create an immediate hazard or danger to property and people.
And can you talk about how long is that money? What are your prospects for getting that grant? How long does the money last? And how many projects can you do with it?
I'm going to let Jim kind of give you some of that background. We've been down, been through it a few times. But we every year, Dale, we approve a AML plan, which we did some time ago now or a few months back, that includes all of the various phases of the projects. The new Beekler Velva project is a brand new one, so we're beginning with phase one of that one, which is why it requires a public input meeting. But Jim, if you want to go ahead and run through some of those numbers, that'd be fine.
Yeah, the construction funds can be used for up to 3 years, but we plan on using most of that within the next year. And the larger projects we're planning for 2010 are the Beekler Velva site, which we're estimating a cost of around $2 million. Then other major projects will be drilling and grouting in the Wilson area, continuing there, then also in the Beulah Zap area. And the total of those will be over $3 million. Then there's some of the administrative costs, then plus the $100,000 for the emergency program.
Where's the Beekler Velva site in relationship to Velva?
It's approximately.
The Beekler site.
It's 10, 12 miles southwest of Velva. And about this, and it's a little bit southeast of Sawyer. So,
okay, sorry,
so Dale.
Sorry to be on Velva.
This wind power thing. Actually, I retold. I left Ashtabula off that list when I added. Ashtabula is 200, assuming those were all brought online this year. And I can't remember if they had any online prior to this, but it was 200, 116 roughly. The Prairie Winds, 157 M Power, Laverne. 149 Rugby, total 622.
Okay.
Double the production in 1 year.
Or thereabouts, yeah. I just can't remember if all 200 of the Ashtabula came on.
Half of it was online the first, the previous year.
That was online last year, and I think that I could check.
Yeah, maybe if you could. It was close. It's either one side or the other, and I don't remember which.
Okay. Is there any doubt that you'll be getting what's almost $3.4 million in grants?
No, there is no doubt about that.
Okay. Okay. And this money can all be spent in a year, projects?
In any of our projects in the next 3 years, yeah.
But it all, if I understood correctly, you've got projects for next year that you can use all this money for?
That's correct.
Okay. I had some questions about the consent agenda.
I do too.
Sure, it's a full one.
Starting at the top, can you explain what the Trans-Canada Keystone item is?
Sure. That's a we had to approve their they do a hazardous liquid integrity management manual that our Office of Pipeline Safety reviews and makes a recommendation, and then we approve it. So that's what that is.
It's approval of their manual?
Yeah, and of their plans for dealing with emergency response, things like that.
You have a copy of this?
Our inspectors are happy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Them going through it.
Do you have a copy of this?
Sure.
Okay.
Alana wants... Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. Is all of it a trade secret? Okay. There's a number of interim application fee refunds. I was wondering if at some point you could let me know which amount for each one of those.
Yeah.
Well, the refunds, yeah, we can do that. I can give you all those amounts.
You just want our, if you want. I mean, there's a sheet attached to each one
right.
that lists the the statutory fee that was collected,
to
how
each
much
motion,
was used. And
but you don't have that probably in
no,
the
I don't.
Agenda. We'll get you that. We hold back. In fact, I was going to ask, do we hold back $5,000 in each one to make sure we have adequate funds in case something should happen, in case the tree mitigation needs doesn't quite meet the standards or some reclamation part of the project? But I think it's $5,000, is it, Jerry?
And these are all projects that have been completed?
Right.
They've
all been sited and constructed.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Completed to the degree that they're in service. Like I say, there might be some reclamation yet to do. Obviously, completed by some standards means 3 years after the trees have been planted to make sure that they've met the revegetation standards, those kinds of things. But yeah, basically they're completed.
But in any case, they're completed enough that the commission's expenses are covered.
That's right.
And you keep the $5,000 in case there's
just in case there's some incidental thing that comes up.
Well, you got some of these you have to send.
We inspect the trees.
They go out.
Yeah, we have a rule on it.
Right.
Sounds like a pretty good party fund too.
Well, and that's the thing we don't like to talk about.
There's a reference to the advanced determination of prudence for the CapEx 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any? Where is that? Where does that process stand presently?
Well, Otter Tail and XL have filed applications. I think have we actually scheduled the hearing yet? I know we talked about it on scheduling, but I can't remember.
We did schedule it. If I'm remembering right, it was the first week in April.
Yeah.
Or second week, something like that.
No, it's like the 7th and 8th. I know, I was just looking at that. So we've scheduled it. This just adopted or appointed advocacy staff. Mike Diller, Alana Jeff Gotsacco, Jerry Lean, our advocacy staff for both of those cases.
Okay. Can I ask about the item C, BK 7 and 8?
Sure.
About MDU and Otter Tail about deferred accounting for Big Stone 2. What?
Yeah.
Can you give us a quick thumbnail about what's going on there?
Well, basically, as you're well aware of, their decision on what they're doing with Big Stone 2 is, that's been in the media quite a bit. Deferred accounting is just, they've got to cover their costs some way. So what they're doing is they're telling us that they're going to put these in a deferred accounting model, if you will, and that at some point in time they'll come back to us potentially and ask for rate recovery for the money they've spent. And it's just a way of them to keep their books correctly. And the big thing, I think, is that, it's at some point in time they'll come back to us and they'll ask for potentially return and include interest on this. So what we're doing here is they're just acknowledging to us that they want to use this method and we'll have to go forward.
What does this mean in terms of, the effect on ratepayers?
Well, nothing right now.
Yeah, that's important, an important fact. It means nothing right now because this is not a determination that they'll be entitled to the recovery of those costs, but rather that we're acknowledging the deferred accounting method.
Just establishes how we'll track those costs.
Right.
Can you explain to me how deferred accounting works? Is there like a explanation for idiots that you can give me?
Well, right now we've broken apart the staff. We've got advocacy staff, and that was the very same question I asked, is at some point in time they'll come back to us with a list of costs, and then we'll go through different versions of it line by line if we think that they're appropriate.
I think it's an accounting method, a way to book those costs without putting them on their current balance sheet. In other words, they will, I don't want to speak for them, but it's costs that are not currently accounted for in their current rates, in their current recovery, their current allowable return on equity. As they defer those costs, perhaps in a future case, they may want to try to apply those in recovery of...
Just setting up a separate account on the books and then adding interest to it.
They didn't build the plant, but they have had costs going into the potential construction.
That's right.
And they may come back and say, we need to have some kind of rate case for this.
Yeah. Jerry's kind of...
Mm-hmm. You've done a pretty good job of it. It basically is an account and rate base, and the money's booked into there. And when we have a rate case next time, or or at some other point we might make a decision on how it will be recovered, or the commission might. But they would earn a return on the money over the period of time that it sits in this deferred account.
Do they need your permission to do this?
I don't think they need our permission to do it. It's just they're letting us know that what they're doing is setting the stage for them to come back at some point in time.
And the appointment of the what I'm trying to get to, the appointment of the advocacy staff is for what purpose?
Well, this kind of, when I walked through it the last couple of weeks, is that, you know, we've got a lot of things out there. We gave them advanced determination and prudence to do something. That's not going to be done, so that's one issue that's out there. We also had today on consent, we set apart the staff to discontinue prudence for MDU, so we've got that pending out there. We've got these two requests for deferred accounting. This is all tied together in the Big Stone 2 scenario, and there's even, you could take it one level, there's Dakota Resource Council has a legal case they filed on this. So we've got all these issues that we're going to be working through over the next year, and we've appointed advocacy staff to advise us as we work through this. This is going to be a big issue.
Any one of which can become and may become litigated, so you have to have advocacy and advisory staff.
And the advocacy staff's purpose as far as the deferred accounting is what?
Well, because it ties together with Big Stone 2, which itself could become a litigated matter. You'd need to have the same staff working on it.
So the upshot here is that the ratepayers of the participating utilities here are going to have to pay for the development cost of a power plant that is not going to be constructed.
We can't say that yet.
Right now, no ratepayer is paying for any of the development costs on that, but at some point in time, they may come back and ask for that.
But that was what I was kind of driving at. The utilities that participated in the construction here, they're going to be asking at some point for reimbursement of the cost they spent developing a project that isn't.
They might decide to build it again. I mean, Otter Tail has not filed anything with us to discontinue prudence, where MDU has. So maybe MDU's. I mean, I am putting words in their mouth. We can't say that.
Right. It's a decision they have to make.
But the purpose for booking these expenses in a deferred account is exactly to do what you've described.
So I'm clear, is the fact that they got an advanced determination of prudence for this project, is that going to make it easier for them to recover their development costs?
It will carry some weight, but the cost will have to be, that's why we have staff breaking it down, because the staff will go through and good cost, bad cost, if you will. But I don't think it'd be unreasonable to think that we couldn't allow some costs because they got advanced determination of prudence.
Well, the statute itself says that they are entitled to recover certain costs. What becomes a question is whether those were prudently incurred costs. The statute does not give carte blanche to a utility once they receive an advanced determination of prudence to gold plate a plan or to spend recklessly or imprudently. But to the degree that the cost is prudently incurred, they have a right under the advanced determination of prudent statute to recover it. So the question really becomes, were these prudently incurred expenses? And that's what you get into the
discussion. Yeah, I guess the question I had, though, is that because they got an advanced determination of prudence, aren't there chances for getting reimbursed for
some part,
most, if not all, of their development costs? Aren't they better?
I think that's a very fair
statement. I would say so.
And is that a good thing?
See, I might fall down. I think we're getting way ahead of this one because, you know, we don't know. Maybe Otter Tail comes back a year from now and decides they're going to build Big Stone 2. You know, we've got a long way to get into this. Maybe it wasn't the right decision for them to pull out of Big Stone 2. But I just think at this point in time, we're setting the stage for some good discussion over the next year that they're going, and this is going to be challenging to put it all through.
I mean, could the argument be made that, hey, you know, it wasn't a prudent decision to pull out of Big Stone 2?
That's what I just threw out there.
I hadn't really thought about that part of it. That'd be kind of an interesting argument.
There's still a demand that needs to be met by these companies that will be growing over time.
Keep in mind,
the virtual wind farm.
Artis Gloria, can you please tell me what that is? It's a CBK4 on the consent agenda. It's a MDU serving something in Morton County called Artis Gloria, and I'm curious.
Person.
It's a human
person.
Being. It's
an individual client.
A yard, or evidently, or somebody's home.
I thought it was maybe a religious school or something.
Those are all requests to extend services. We did the notice. Nobody objected, and so we're approving that.
That's a great name. The trade secret protection order on Northern States Power,
About a year ago that, you know, their meters were having lots of problems, so we requested that they do an internal investigation, internal audit, if you will. The GEM Corporation did all those things. They came back with a very detailed plan of action, and they've asked, they being NSP, has asked for trade secret protection for certain pages and parts of that action plan. So that's really what it comes down to.
The bioenergy case, is any, I mean, you mentioned that there are some potential clients.
Yes.
That want this gas.
Yes.
Can any, the question I have is, can any client, say, for example, I built a really nice house down there.
Yes.
I decided that I wanted natural gas.
Yes.
Could I?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, you could. And I would be surprised if, given that investment has been made, that there's a 16-mile natural gas pipeline in a vicinity that isn't perhaps going to enjoy some growth, I'd be surprised if the company itself wasn't out marketing that very thing. Realizing, of course, is the tariff that governs this means that the cost causer pays 100% of the development or construction costs of any taps and distribution lines and things that would lead to your home, your grain dryer, your farm, your mill, whatever it is that you might be doing. The nice thing about that is that, of course, every customer that comes online that participates has value to the entire MDU system and every customer on the MDU system, of course. Dale, to be honest, this is just me, envisioning the future a little bit, but I hope that there is. I hope that we do see more natural gas distribution in the southeastern and the entire eastern part of the state coming from some of these large gas transmission lines that up until recently we've not been able to tap into, somewhat because of the indexes that determine price, but that commodity is becoming more and more, of course, a nationally traded commodity because of these large transmission lines. But you add to that the fact that we're talking now about those lines and their capacity providing more opportunity for North Dakota produced natural gas to get into the marketplace. It's a win-win situation west to east.
I mean, remember, it's been within just the last few years that we've had discussions with WBI, MDU, XL, others trying to figure out how we can get more natural gas into the eastern part of the state because we just lack a pipeline capacity, distribution capacity in that area. From the west, the WBI system keeps getting smaller as it heads towards the valley, and from the east there have been there are constraints as well. XL has helped that situation actually with an extension off the Viking line, as you know about. But especially as you get into eastern North Dakota for industrial use, natural gas supplies have not been where I think we would hope that they would be for an economic development standpoint. So things like this are good news.
But the fact of the matter is, and when I was the economic development director, we dealt with this a lot, and the answer that the utilities always gave, and understandably so, was that while there's a desire for it, there was no guaranteed tenant or guaranteed customer on the other end willing to pay the price to get it. Here you have U.S. Bio that becomes that initiator, if you will. And so a 16-mile tap is able to be built and price has been able to be received and all of those things that now make it economically feasible. And so the company's out marketing it, and I think it's great.
You expect it'll change that the person buying the gas will have to pay 100% of the hookup cost? Would that be a deterrent to the kind of spreading of this fuel source?
That's a good. I guess I don't know. I hadn't ever thought about that.
Depends on their cost numbers. What if the cost of a different fuel is more, and they're willing to pay some cost hookups? It's.
Yeah, I just don't know how much it costs.
I don't think it's a deterrent because I think tariffs like that are pretty common across the country. You'd have to look at what it would mean relative to other sites that they might select and. It's very common for utility commissions to require things like that to be borne by the cost causer.
Could you tell me one more time, please, how much land was released on bond this year?
The total amount released on bond this year was, with today's, is 4,653 acres.
And there has been,
that's a total. That brings us to a total acreage of final bond release lands to 20,916 acres.
Okay, and that's the amount of land that's been released from bonds since the bond program or since the reclamation program
started. That's even pre-reclamation. I mean, there are two sort of time periods. There's the post-1979 permits, and then there's the pre-1979 permits, and this includes all of it.
January 1st of 1970.
Yeah.
January 1st of 1970.
Those are pre-Dean Peterson mine.
Yeah.
And what? And
they're
what?
Pre, they're pre-Jim Dyke.
And what? What?
Here 50 years.
What would you? What would you attribute this to? This increase?
Oh, a few things. Some of it's just the natural progression of things, given the maturity of several of these mines. I mean, one of the interesting things about this year's alone is that these 4,600 plus acres includes all of the remaining permitted acreage at the two Royal Oak mines near Dickinson, BNI's Larson mine near Noonan, and then the American Colloid Smith Almond mine near Hettinger. So we're just seeing the maturity of a lot of mined lands now catching up. One of the goals that we've talked about in the past, Dale, we like to remind people that the industry roughly disturbs the same number of acres each year as are reclaimed. We get to the point where we are actually providing final bond release, releasing finally the bonds on the same number of acres that each year as are disturbed. Then I think we've got that balance that a lot of people desire, and I think we're pretty close to there, Jim. We'd have to look it up to be sure, but we're getting pretty close to there. Right. I think it's generally about 2,000 or so acres.
Can you tell me how much land is under bond?
Right now there's 105,000 acres under permit. Does that sound right, Jim?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, so there's 105,000 acres under permit. Almost 21,000 acres have been released from bond since January 1st of 1970, and out of those, 4,653 were released this year.
That's correct. And now, Jim, tell me, I think they disturb roughly, 2,000 plus acres per year?
Then of the 105 that's under permit right now, there's probably a little over half of that that's been disturbed by mining, and either active mining or reclaim.
Right. That's a good point.
And the American Colloid was a Leonardite mine, and the other is of course, a lignite mine, I presume.
Yes. That's correct. I'm always amused by the definition of Leonardite as a low-quality lignite. It seemed redundant to me.
Really.
Dr. Leonard, did you? Yeah.
Yeah. How'd you like it being named for you? I have this really, really, really low-quality coal name.
Sort of like.
Yeah, I know. It's like the Mad Dog 2020 of coal.
Sort of like an unsuccessful Cub season.
All right. If there's not anything else, Dean, did you want to make your announcement now or for your candidacy? Oh, you're waiting for the light to go off.
Since Bob's in the room now, Bob, are you giving Dean a job?
With that, we'll close the meeting and sign orders, and we'll come back for the admin portion in a few minutes.